Welcome to the College Commons Podcast, passionate perspectives from Judaism's leading thinkers, brought to you by HUC Connect, the Hebrew Union College's online platform for continuing education. I'm Joshua Holo, your host. Welcome to this episode of the College Commons Podcast and our conversation with Rabbi Charles E. Savinor. Rabbi Savinor is the Executive Director of Civic Spirit. The mission of Civic Spirit is to educate, inspire, and empower schools across faith traditions to enhance civic knowledge, responsibility, and belonging in their student and faculty communities. Rabbi Savinor was ordained at the Jewish Theological Seminary of America and came to Civic Spirit in 2022 after serving as the Director of Congregational Education at Park Avenue Synagogue in New York. His articles on education, parenting, leadership, and Judaism in the 21st century have appeared in the likes of the Jerusalem Post, the Jewish Week, the New York Observer, Kveller, Hadassah Magazine, and the Boston Jewish Advocate. And I'm pleased to announce that he has just won the 2026 Covenant Award for Excellence in Jewish Education. Rabbi Charles Savinor, congratulations and welcome. Thank you for joining the College Commons Podcast.
It's really wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
In your latest article titled A Civic Practice for America at 250, you argue something very compelling with a really great turn of phrase. You write, faith traditions offer a language of responsibility that civic discourse often lacks. Elaborate, if you would, with examples of what you mean. Perhaps one Jewish example and one non-Jewish example.
Thank you for asking that question. We live at a time where the source of leadership and character is not always clear. I'd like to believe it comes from our schools. I'd like to believe that it can come from the media. I'd like to believe that it can come from public communal leadership. But unfortunately, that's not always the case. There's acrimony in the school world. There's division in the political or the government world. And with the expansion of TV and podcasts and the like, those medium thrive on friction and tension and division. And so we have at this moment somewhat of a character education challenge in American society. So at Civic Spirit, we lean into faith because we believe that faith has a lot to offer America at this time. Not religion per se, but faith values. One of the important things to understand is that in order to really get a grasp on what America is about, one needs to understand faith. Not all of the founders were religious men, but all of them were shaped by faith values. So this is a place where in the public square, faith values can really elevate the conversation and enhance our interactions with one another. And I believe, to give you an example, that Judaism has a lot to contribute to this endeavor. For example, we're the people of the book, Mikra. We embrace the idea of machloket l'shem shamayim, arguments for the sake of heaven. We have a vigorous pursuit of tzedek, of justice and law. And then finally, our value of tzedakah, I would say, is not just charity, but it's also generosity of spirit. And I strongly believe that the Jewish community and other faith communities can leverage the best of their faith values for the betterment of American society at a time that it's needed most. Faith values, not religion itself.
What strikes you as an outstanding example from the non-Jewish faith universe?
With Civic Spirit, we work with Jewish, Catholic, and Christian schools. And we are an organization that was founded by members of the Jewish community about 2/3 of our schools are from the Jewish community, and at the moment, about 60% of our funding comes from members of the Jewish community as well. And having said that, we are committed to being multi-faith because we believe that real change in this country and in any society happens when people work together towards common cause. The world is not going to change simply because Sinai Temple decides it's time to do X, Y, and Z. It's usually going to happen when people lock arms towards a common destination. So I've been really inspired by our work with Catholic schools in particular. There are many denominations of Catholicism, and each one has their own approach to what they call Catholic social action, where they apply their values to the public square. And in doing so, they build the character in the community of their school, the church, but they also apply that to the larger community. The values in the Catholic community line up with the Jewish community in terms of what are issues that we face. And in this case, let's take intense political polarization. How can empathy, love, listening, an idea that redemption is possible, lead us to generosity of spirit in other people and also build towards something better for our shared society?
Is it reasonable or understandable for some people to fear the injection of faith as a conversation piece in the civic enterprise as a potential undermining of the separation of church and state? And I'm careful to distinguish between faith and religion because you were careful to make that distinction. But still, even talking about faith as a more abstract commitment, can you understand why some people might feel a little bit worried about that?
100%. With the rise of Christian nationalism in the United States, I think we have every reason to be cautious about the idea of bringing faith itself into the public square. There's a really interesting case going on right now in the Boston area that's in the Massachusetts Supreme Court about religious icons being put on a firehouse in Quincy, Mass, to honor members of their crew who were killed in the line of duty. The position of the firehouse is these are the patron saints of the fire department. But right as they are about to put these sculptures up on the firehouse, this court case was brought. And the argument is, why are you putting religious symbols on a public institution? I personally was disheartened by this because the position of the firehouse is we're not advertising faith. We're using a faith symbol to comfort our community and inspire us about the responsibility and duty that we have for another, and that is the underpinnings of the service that we provide. So your excellent question really points to how this can get confusing. And it's part of the reason why in the work that we do, we talk about bringing faith values, not even just faith, into the public square, because it is a slippery slope. I don't want anybody telling me how to live my life in a religious way in this country, and I don't want to tell anybody how to do it as well. But I do believe what's missing at this moment in our country is those values that are assisting with the development of character in young people today.
So I'm going to ask you about the Johnson Amendment, the rule whereby a church cannot advocate for a candidate during campaign season if it wants to maintain its nonprofit status for tax purposes. It has been severely weakened by the Trump administration, and it is now somewhat of a controversial topic. Do the changes in the Johnson Amendment intersect at all with Civic Spirit's mission? And regardless of whether or not it intersects, what are your thoughts on the Johnson Amendment in relation to the separation of church and state?
The weakening of the Johnson Amendment does not intersect with Civic Spirit's work at all. And I believe its weakening does not help religious leaders and their communities. I know from my experience working at Park Avenue and at the Aunt Jemet Synagogue in Chicago earlier in my career that you can talk about issues, but when you get into politics on the Bema, it is a lose-lose proposition. And so I'm really glad you asked about this because I really feel it sets up a situation where clergy are playing a different role for their communities than giving them religious inspiration and instruction. So that type of injection of politics into a faith community rather than faith values into the public square, it's a really dangerous proposition, especially with the rise of Christian nationalism.
As part of your project of America 250, Civic Spirit has published, together with the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, a really wonderful collection of essays called The Talmud of America. And in The Talmud of America, Jewish scholars parse out in Talmudic style and format key ideas that emerge from the Declaration of Independence. And I want everyone to know that it's really wonderful. And I want to pick up on one of the essays titled Prudence and the Right of Rebellion by Leah Rosenthal. In her essay, Rosenthal appreciates that the Founding Fathers took up rebellion against Britain only after tremendously ponderous deliberation and after the exhaustion of all other remedies, at least as they saw it. I want to follow up on Rosenthal's problem and ask you, what happens to the authority of a government that does not merely claim, but actually enshrines rebellion as a right?
George Washington called the United States of America the great experiment in self-government. What we've been trying to do here in America for 250 years is unheard of. A democratic republic, we are the longest functioning democracy in human history. And I believe that we will be here for many more years to come. By enshrining the opportunity to petition the government, we were doing something that was unheard of. I'm so glad you asked this, because immediately after the revolution, there was an uprising in the newly formed United States that was the Whiskey Rebellion, where farmers in Pennsylvania rebelled because they had to pay taxes. They said, I thought we went to war against Britain about taxes. We threw the tea, didn't we? So now you're going to charge us taxes on our whiskey? You're going to be crazy. Washington did not take this sitting down. He welcomed the feedback, but ultimately he realized in that moment that the citizens of this new country didn't fully understand the enterprise of self-government. And so he went as far as sending troops out to Western Pennsylvania as a way of saying, let's all reorient ourselves here. And I think actually your question is a great segue to the importance of civic education. The founders of this country understood that the purpose of civic education was a vehicle for social cohesion. I think we're facing that same challenge today. If you don't know how the system works, how are you going to change it? And how are you going to have your voice heard? And how will you make sure that your grievance is an invitation to a conversation and not the first stone thrown in a war? So, yeah, this democracy thing is not easy. And when I finished rabbinical school 30 years ago, I never in my life dream that I'd be sitting in civic education summits or in civic education meetings all across the country. But there is a basic lack of understanding of how government works. And along with that, how we can get involved in the enterprise of self-government. Going back to your original question, freedom of religion, freedom of petition, freedom of the press. These were innovations. These individuals created a society. It was almost like a dream. What would it look like? What would it feel like? How would we administer? How would we govern it? And we're the beneficiaries of that. But to go one step further, if we lose our perspective and with that gratitude on what American self-government means, it's very easy for our questions to become grievances about the whole darn thing.
Which I think January 6th illustrated, and I think it was motivated by this problem, which is America claimed the right of rebellion when petition failed, and then acted on that right, rebelled violently against their sovereign, the King of England. And now certain quarters feel that their petitions are not being met. They're therefore justified in taking this momentous step. And then they look to the founding fathers as validation.
I think one of the fun parts of history is history can serve many purposes, and history can serve as a validation for many of our contemporary initiatives. Civic Spirit ran a great webinar at the 250th anniversary of the Boston Tea Party. And it is amazing to hear over the course of 250 years how the Tea Party has been used by so many different groups as a vehicle to showcase their issue at that time. So yeah, America's 250th really, I believe, creates this opportunity for us to look in the mirror, to ask serious questions, and equally important, perhaps most importantly, ask us, where are we going from here?
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview. I'd like to ask your thoughts on the very delicate and problematic conflation of two closely related words and ideas, civic and civil. Precisely because of today's polarized, angry public discourse, which you cited earlier, we hear many calls for civility, which I think is fair to say comprises a certain bundle of attitudes connoted by the word civility. And they include, for example, moderation of tone, fully listening to one's interlocutor, avoidance of direct accusation, etc. Moreover, I infer that civility implicitly and maybe even explicitly undergirds much of civic spirit's approach. However, civility increasingly is seen as a tool of the empowered to dampen the urgency of the claims of the disempowered. If, in its way, civility is the authorized idiom of the civic project, but if that civic project has failed so many for so long, is it understandable that disenfranchised people should view civility as a code for the perpetuation of their exclusion or their cynical appeasement.
Let me take one step back. The only subject area that sounds less appealing than medieval Jewish history is civic education. No offense to you or your colleagues. I love you all and I respect you all and I own your books. But when I tell people I've gone from my focus being Jewish education to civic education, I get sympathetic nods and followed up with, what exactly is that? So civic education is really the education one needs to receive to be an informed and engaged member of a society, a country, a nation. And civic education in the United States is different than civic education in Israel or in, let's say, Russia. They all have civics in one way, shape, or form, but they're not the same because our constitutions and our histories are all different. So having said that, the word civics is related to civility. It is also connected loosely to citizenship. So in all of that is this understanding of, yes, civility, if we're going to have common cause, if we're going to do something together, then I imagine that we have to get along with one another, that we have to look at strangers as neighbors with the potential that neighbors can become our friends and partners. And if we lose that, then we're lost. There was a Pew study 3 years ago, I believe, that said that 50% of Americans don't know their neighbors and that 50% of millennials don't want to know their neighbors. What type of country, what type of society, what type of public square do we create when we don't know who the other people are? Hirsch Goldberg Poland's father, John Poland, spoke at my kid's high school in New York recently. And when John was asked about some of his recent statements, he talked about wanting Hirsch's memory to be a revolution. And in different parts of his statements, he spoke about the need for moderation. And so the high school student who was the moderator called them on this. Can we have a revolution? And is that the value or is moderation the value? And John's response was brilliant. He said, we should have a revolution of moderation. It doesn't mean that we all give up. It doesn't mean that we create a silence of civility. It means that we become committed to moderation, to understanding that nobody holds all of the truth at one time. I think that's kind of what's needed today in American society. I mean, you created this amazing podcast, which is a vehicle not just to share ideas, but to get different people listening to different forms of ideas that are different from their own. That's not the norm today. Your podcast and what Civic Spirit is trying to do 365 days a year is to get people in a room to talk about things that matter to all of us, to listen to one another and agree that the future belongs to all of us and that people on the other side, I don't even like that expression, are not our enemies, as I've heard people called in that way. They're our partners in an enterprise in which we don't agree, but we have to agree what comes next needs to be best for our children and their children after them.
I'm heartened by everything you're saying, but I'm also aware of a subset of the American population who feels that it's difficult to enter that civil, moderate, and civic conversation because they feel they've been left out a priori. And that to join that conversation under the rules of civility that have been written in their absence feels like a setup, I think. I'm not speaking for myself, so I hope I'm being fair-minded, but that's my understanding.
My reaction to your question is, are you talking about the national scene, the state scene? Are you talking about in a city or town? I imagine you know for your excellent work in media is that since 2005, I believe, that two local newspapers close every week in the United States of America. Two local papers every week. So what's been filling in has been national news. And national news becomes the bright, shiny object that we talk about all the time. And by the way, that's print media. In terms of local television, I don't know why the second or third story on my local news here in New York is about what's happening in Washington, D.C. I care deeply about what's happening in Washington, D.C., but there's other stuff that's going on in New York that also demands my attention. And also, I care about the mayoral election in L.A., but we got our own elections here in New York.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm talking about my local New York news. So I think maybe the underpinnings of your question is, how can I have my voice heard? And civility is almost like a salve
yes.
to just make me feel good. It's just language to ameliorate myself in the situation. If we're looking on the national level, I think you might be right. But on a local level, that's where real civics can take place. And that's part of the work that we do with Civic Spirit. We work with teachers, we work with students, and we work with schools and communities overall. And our fellowships and our clubs all have a project attached to them. And the one stipulation we have is that they focus on a local civic challenge. We're trying to teach students that the on-ramp to civic engagement is on a local level. You might ask, well, how could that be? There's the traffic light or traffic sign is the classic example. But the Heschel School in LA took a science unit from third or fourth grade about the monarch butterfly. The monarch butterfly is becoming extinct. And in your area, what a monarch butterfly needs in order to survive and thrive is milkweed. So the fellows from the school who participated in Civic Spirit, their project was to take this science unit and turn it into a civic enterprise, where it became a spiral curriculum throughout the school, making students aware of the problem. Students were making posters and making a campaign to plant more milkweed. Students met with the board of directors of the Heschel School and asked for permission for the school to plant milkweed on the grounds. Older students invited in elected officials so that they could promote the planting of milkweed in the area around the school. And now they're launching a campaign of meeting with different schools in the area, asking them to join with Common Cause here. I am so excited for these students as much as I am for the monarch butterfly, because on a local level, we can see something grow. If we only look to DC, we're spectators in self-government. And our founders imagined that we could all have a hand in our governance. And that's the message that we want to give to the next generation here in the United States, Jewish, Catholic, Christian, Muslim, otherwise. The country is really theirs. And if they don't approach it through the lens of an informed and engaged citizen, they're going to ask who else is going to do it. There's a great book, by the way, by I think Rabbi Robert Levine called There Is No Messiah and You're It. Another version might be There Is No Civic Messiah and You're It.
In a wonderful formulation, you speak of teaching pluralism as civic discipline. How does that discipline differ depending on where you sit in the demographic map of a pluralistic population? How do you exercise that discipline, for example, differently if you're a member of a disenfranchised minority versus if you're a member of the empowered majority?
Your question speaks to the philosophy of civic spirit. One of our pillars, in addition to civic knowledge and civic skills, is this idea of civic attitudes. And when we bring teachers and students together, we ask, when was the last time you were in a room with people different from yourself when you weren't competing against them? Sports, debate, model UN, model this or that. Almost no hands go up. So we believe strongly that when we bring groups together, that people are in the room as partners on a local level. We work very hard to meet in a neutral civic location, a museum, a library, something like that, so that no one's hosting us. If anything, the public square is the host. And when we work together, no one is a mitzvah project for the other person. No one is a charity case for the other party. I've seen too many times in our career where the Jewish community, for all the right reasons, is there to help out. But it sometimes sends the wrong message. The way that we can help out the most is to show people that we're their partners in a common cause. And I think that's a message that students today need to internalize and embrace.
Leave us from this interview with a story of an event, an interaction, a surprise that took you by the lapels and shook you up since you've joined Civic Spirit.
Great question. Civic Spirit holds day-long conferences for high school and middle school kids. And they're called Civic Spirit Days. We just held one here in New York at the New York Historical. And I invited a philanthropist to come see the program, and she was only able to come for the second half of the day. We had about 100 kids there from Catholic schools, Christian schools, Jewish schools, all throughout the metropolitan New York area. And our theme was America 250 and civic leadership. And yeah, we toured the museum, and then we had a panel, and then kids had to come up with a presentation of an idea of something that reflected the themes of the day. We started at 9 a.m. and we got done at 3. So at 3 o'clock, these high school kids, who many of them got there on their own by train or whatever, number one is they didn't leave. It was like, it's over, you can go. But kids are talking to each other. They're exchanging information, phone numbers, emails. It was really heartwarming. My friend, who I invited to this event, comes over to me and says, did these kids know each other before today? And I said, no. Most of these kids had not known each other till 9 o'clock this morning. She was just blown away, as I was. I was just feeling this in my heart and my soul, you know, in my mind as I watched it. But to someone who just walked in, was surprised that kids who were really different from one another, that they were talking to each other and acting like they had something in common. And I can tell you, because I know these schools, there's a real difference of opinion about a lot of different stuff, from philosophy to theology to politics. There's more that distinguishes these schools and kids from each other than unites them. But you wouldn't have noticed it after 6 hours of these kids being together and understanding that they live in the same community, and that what happens next here in New York, just as an example of one city, is something that they're going to create. It's a chapter they're going to write. And I could say to you, it surprises me, because it that moment did, but it's one that I see all the time through our work. And whenever I feel somewhat hesitant and cautious about the future, I go to work and I believe that tomorrow can be better than today.
Well, here's to tomorrow being better to today. Thank you for your work at Civic Spirit. Thank you for joining us on the College Commons podcast. And congratulations on the Covenant Award, Rabbi Charlie Savinor.
Thank you so much.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.